Welcome to Turning Pages, a series of in-depth conversations with authors about their works.
All right. Well, he is an agricultural policy fellow at Yale. Austin Frerich's book, Barons, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry, is out through Island Press, and he joins me on the show. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on, Michael.
My pleasure. So this book, as you write in the conclusion, started with a barroom conversation about a private jet.
Yeah. I mean, to me, the best conversations always happen dive bars. So yeah, I'm from Iowa, and in 2018, there was a big governor's race. And I didn't know this at the time, but Iowa doesn't have campaign contribution limits for state level races. So this guy was telling me how the largest donor in Iowa was this hog farmer who gave over $300,000 to the governor's reelection campaign, and how he not only has his home is in the only gated community in Iowa, he also has a home down in Naples, Florida, and he flies back and forth between the two on his private jet with allegedly the words "when pigs fly" on it. So like, that's how this whole thing started. Was I was like, oh, first of all, that's incredible copy. But two, what a powerful symbol of where we are.
The private jet, the second home, the fact that this farmer, when we think about, you know, farming, I mean, we don't think about agribusiness necessarily, but that's where the majority of this comes from. And it's something you examine in full. So the Hansen story then becomes an article in Vox, as you write. Mm-hmm. But then, like, at what point does saying, okay, the Hansens are one element of this like food picture, I'm going to paint the whole picture, or at least bigger picture. When do you decide that, and how do you go about kind of figuring that out?
It was what I realized writing that hog piece in Vox was, there's this notion that, oh, this is efficiency, this is technology. And you're like, no, the real story is this is just regulatory capture. So then writing that and then seeing how it was received, but then also realizing this story could be told throughout the food system, you know, is there's all these different structures that really collapsed or been captured by the rich throughout the food system in this neoliberal era. It's like how I kind of put it together in my head. And I've been working on a book for a while, but then I realized, oh, this Robert Barron framework is a really powerful narrative device to tell these bigger structural stories. So when I laid out the seven barons in my book, they're actually like, I figured out the structures I wanted to talk about. And then I found that, you know, the right Robert Barron to tell those stories.
Okay. So you did kind of like map it out in the macro sense before going micro on individual barons.
Yep. And like, I even like changed out my barons, where like, for example, Driscoll's is my berry baron. They sell 1 in 3 berries, but don't grow a single berry. I was originally going to use them to tell the story of the farm bill, but then I was like, no, there's this whole thing going on over here about the offshoring of the produce system. So I kind of, you know, I swap out my players, but the structures to me are the most important thing.
So then you go to Cargill for the farm bill.
Yeah.
So, and this is we'll skip right to it, just because I have some sense, because, you know, the American system is essentially the global system when it comes to food production, right? Like there are a couple of, you know, there's a Brazilian player, there's a German player, but a lot of these are American companies, but like the playbook seems to be universally exploited around the world. The Cargill thing, though, I didn't know about some of this stuff around the New Deal farm bill and then what you call the Wall Street farm bill that essentially, like, I don't want to say replaces, but like supplants it.
Yeah, supplants it. Like, just for your listeners, I mean, the whole New Deal farm bill comes out of the Dust Bowl, where you had land, the markets were glutted, and people were producing like too much because they're pushing their land to save their land. And you need to figure out, like, I call it like the Goldilocks thing, where how do you produce just enough? So the farm bill system comes along where you get subsidies, but it's tied to conservation. And usually that conservation was take land out of production to kind of stabilize prices. I tell the story in my book of how the Cargill family, and by the way, they're the largest private company in America. I mean, they're bigger than the Koch brothers. They hated this system because they're all about transporting and processing grain. So anything that kind of reduces that, they inherently don't like. So, you know, they systematically had been attacking the farm bill, which is, you know, approved every 5 to 7 years in America. And then where I really focus on is the 1996 one, where to me that's what I call the Wall Street farm bill, where it just goes off the rails, where now, the system is now designed for Wall Street. It's about overproducing grains at the expense of everything else. So what used to be interlocking, is those interlocks are gone. And also a lot of the caps in the programs are gone. So for example, like crop insurance, when people hear that, they think, oh, that's insurance for a rainy day. It's really not. It's really for like, it's insurance for low prices. And the government picks up 60% of the premium and there's no cap. So like Bill Gates is one of the largest owner of farmland in America. He can get as much crop insurance as he wants for, you know, the guard against low prices. So what you realize is this system now is crowding out a lot of the produce and all the fresh things, and America's overproducing mostly the grains.
Now, you grew up in Iowa. You grew up, you know, with farm ties. How much of the, like, system stuff did you have an understanding of before you started researching, and how much of this was, like, entirely new to you through the research process?
It's a really good question. I'd say a lot of entirely new, but what you realize is models replicate. So like when I talk a lot about Driscoll's, they do a sharecropping model production. I've never seen anyone really write about that, but I've read a lot about chicken. Chicken is infamous for engaging in the sharecropping model production. And I just realized, oh, they're doing the same thing that I see over here, and it just hasn't been appreciated. And so I also just like think for structures. I think that's how you have to understand how someone amasses power and how things got to a certain point in order to do the change you need to do, because you need to understand which corners were cut. So I think writing that hog piece really ingrained in me of like, oh, all these corners were cut, so we need to uncut them in order to like fix the system.
Okay, so speaking of fix the system, in the conclusion you write, you know, the system's broken. However, you had a mentor that suggested that, no, it's not broken, but that's suggested ever worked.
Yes. I mean, that's the great thing of like writing a book over 5 years. It's just like I really marinated on these ideas, workshop these ideas. And there's a habit in people in my world to glorify some Aguilarian past. And you just realize there's lessons to learn from the past, but we shouldn't. There's a really dark undercurrent. I mean, the New Deal Farm Bill is great for white farmers, but it came at the expense of the black farmers. And so that's kind of, to me, I rather focus on moving forward of like, how do we build a multicultural food system that's more sustainable and centered on labor?
How often in the research phase did you just get angry?
I'm not sure if I get angry, I get sad.
Okay.
Like if you read my Vox article to what my hog chapter became in the book, it just reads it's much sadder now to me. My anger, like, to me, the angriest part of the book is, weird as it sounds, the Secretary Vilsack in the JBS chapter. That's my slaughtering baron chapter.
Disappointment in terms of what he might have been or suggested he was before.
My anger at him is he pretends to help people and stabs them in the back. That's really angered me. And he was my governor of Iowa growing up and I liked him. And I just didn't realize the trickery going on. I don't have a lot of anger at these barons because, I mean, I might be a little numb to it, but you can't write a book like this and you just interact with people that have been, you know, screwed by these barons or shortchanged. And, you know, you just see the sadness on their face. And at the same time, too, I met a lot of people doing the right thing and you just realize it's just a few greedy people holding this back. And so it gave me hope and like, oh, I'm not cynical about, you know, the system per se. It's just, we could be better. It doesn't have to be this way.
Like you said, it could be better. It needs to be different, I think, if it's going to be a better system. And that's kind of ties back to what we were saying about, you know, the system never truly working, right? Because like you said, the farm bill, essentially, it was kind of like redlining for black farmers, you know, if people are familiar with that in terms of the housing applications. But yeah, that's something that you talk about, I think, it's a recurrent motif that you address in each of the Barron stories in how this plays out, that like structural prohibitions or paths that people take that either break from norms or just like take advantage of opportunities to... Like, I get what you're saying. It's just a few people, but like anyone could follow this kind of path.
Yeah. But like, Michael, I kind of have this notion of this moment in time we're living through is cyclical. Like, it's such an aha moment I had a few years ago, but the goal of any corporate executive is monopoly.
Mm-hmm.
That's what our profits are. So you're always going to have a fundamental tension between government not wanting monopolies to stifle innovation. You know, it's not good for workers or farmers, and business do. And so, you know, at some point, their business are going to keep chipping away and it's going to go too far and creates a Gilded Age moment that eventually ushers in a reform movement because it goes too far. That's kind of why I'm also using that Robert Barron framework, because I'm pulling from that past, you know, historical moment. to show we've been here before, we know what to do. And so like that's kind of where I go back to in that regard.
So the purposeful nature of calling them barons is to remind people that we did address barons in the past?
Yeah. And also just it's how cartoonish they are. I mean, that's, I want people to find like, oh, this is so morally ridiculous. Let's do something about it. Like it's ridiculous that there's a berry baron, that, you know, someone has a peanut butter monopoly. I mean, that is, I purposely love my book pointing out cartoonish details of these people. Like my dairy baron secretly lives at the Ritz-Carlton, Puerto Rico. Because it's just, it's such a morally wrong, outrageous thing that it's such a unifying device.
And then dresses themselves in the flag of the United States to, you know, talk about like patriotic nature of consumption.
Yeah. And like, I'm a big believer that the weirdest, reform movements usually happen when weird bedfellows get together. I mean, even like the dairy industry, I mean, the whole, you said earlier about the American system being the global system, but that's breaking down in front of us. I mean, you had it boiling up between the EU and US right before the Russian invasion of Ukraine, of just, we cannot do the American model of agricultural production with climate change. Like, right. You just can't. It's so fossil fuel intensive. It's so, you know, toxic. And like, even like, I think right now with even in North America, where you have Mexico just straight up saying no to American industrial corn, and the tension with the Canadian dairy system is just, you guys don't want this dairy model. They see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, it's true.
It says a lot that, like, I think one of Biden's worst political appointees was Secretary Vilsack at U.S. Department of Agriculture, because he's just a former industrial dairy lobbyist who's failed at the job. The meat markets have gotten more concentrated these last 4 years. And that was such a weird bipartisan pinata in America to, like, reform these cartels.
You mentioned that the Vox piece, it's the resulting chapter is sadder. That, but in terms of the process of expanding it from the piece to what the chapter becomes, did that lay the model for like how you would address all the chapters?
Yes and no. I mean, it's part of it is, I did a chunk of this in my family's camper and cabins up in Northeast Iowa. And like, the more you're in these spaces, I just felt like I got sadder and sadder, but also from like a writing perspective, I try to change up the narratives in each chapter. I feel like, I don't know. I'm really curious, like, you know, as a reader, like, what people think, because it's also, I mean, I'm so immersed in these words for 5 years. I don't really know how they emotionally hit people anymore. But I didn't want to do the same chapter. Mm-hmm. So that's why, like, for example, I view my hog baron as like trashy Florida money. But then like Cargill to me is like this aristocratic waspy, you know, money. And so I don't know. I mean, what chapter to you did you feel the most moral outrage at?
Well, the Cargill one definitely hit because of the environmental impact.
Mm-hmm.
As much as obviously like the hog barns are affecting, you know, like the water near where your family grew up, just in terms of like the like global reach of this and the like shedding of the protections in terms of like laying fields fallow, right? Like that, like, first of all, the like global shipping is in itself an issue. Yeah. When it comes to climate and you know, sending things overseas. That one, although admittedly, like, you know, the treatment of workers by like in the Driscoll's one, and the fact that like they basically shield themselves from any legal liability by sharecropping is kind of wild. Like, I did not know when I've gotten, you know, strawberries that have the Driscoll's thing on it, that like they don't actually do anything but like hold the patent on those strawberries.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I guess, 2 points to that is, number one, I thought when I asked people that question, like which baron bothers you the most, it'd be a unified answer. And it's truly all over the board. Mm-hmm. And also I think that's, it's kind of a reflection of people's moral compasses or like which stories they really click to. But the other thing is, I mean, this is really credit to my husband of, you know, I joke our biggest fights these last few years were when I got his edits back, because he was just vicious with his red pen.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But I mean, I loved it. I mean, the best writing takes a long time, takes distillation. And he really taught me, he really helped me tone down my polemicism.
Okay.
Where I don't need to tell you how to think. Let me just lay these facts out. Let me just tell you, this is what Driscoll's doing. I don't need that concluding sentence telling you how I feel. Like I need to trust you as a reader to know, you know, this is morally wrong. I don't need an outrageous statement.
So are you in a sense like writing yourself out of it? Like, is that what he's trying to coach you towards? Or is it that like your voice is there, but like your conclusions aren't?
I would say he's writing, my voice is there because I weave in like my personal experiences, but I try to edit out my feelings. That was the big thing. And like actually not being, I can't say this word, right? Hyperbole, like not being over top with my rhetoric of just almost underplaying it gives it more power, as weird as that sounds.
Right, that you, if you just kind of present it without like proselytizing for it, it has a more like resonant impact.
100%. And I think we live in such an over the top rhetorical moment that I actually think that rhetoric carries more weight now.
So that was obviously something your husband kind of brought to the table. Like, did you realize kind of what he was trying to push you towards in that respect? Or like, did that just make sense? Like, oh yeah, like maybe I don't need to be pedantic about this.
That's a really good question. I think that's how he is. I mean, he's just he's an in-house lawyer for a low-income hospital. He's a very even-keeled person. And I think, this is anyone that's written a book, it's always weird to have friends and family edit up, you know, give you feedback, because a lot of people edit for their voice, not your voice.
Mm-hmm.
And so workshopping that together and getting his input was, you know, figuring out how do I maintain what I'm trying to say. I'm also like, you can kind of tell when you talk to me, my brain kind of bops around. And he was really good at like honing me in. But it was just, I think for him, it's just like the level-headedness is kind of like, because I think part of it too is I really want to, this sounds weird to say, I want to own the middle, because it's really easy for industry to dismiss someone like me as like, oh, a radical crazy. And that's what they do. But I really want the reader to take away the system we have now is radical. Mm-hmm. It is radical that one man has 5 million hogs. And so like my goal is I really want to own the middle and talk about how a lot of these reforms we're talking about are actually very traditional. So I guess it's kind of a rhetorical play at the same time too.
Right.
That makes sense.
And maybe he, as a lawyer, is like building a case. So you like kind of take it methodically and sequentially. And
yes.
If you're bringing, you know, emotion and your kind of scattershot approach to play, the chapter wouldn't quite build the same way.
100%. As I get older, I realize how much my mom's New Deal Catholicism has really shaped me, of a very strong sense of right and wrong. And that's totally reflective in that. Like, I don't want to lose that point of view, but I really wanted to hone it. I mean, I also have to say my book editor was incredible in that regard. And I think truly embracing the fact that it takes a village, it's a team effort to put something like this together. I mean, that's really what I've learned writing a book.
Did you get a different type of feedback from your editor than your husband? Like, was it like more in the like mechanics of things, or what was the kind of interplay there?
Yes. For a while, it took us for my husband and I, it really took a while to kind of figure. I'm not a narrative writer naturally. You know, I was taught to be like thesis, evidence. So the whole notion of storycraft really did take me a while to get used to, especially even like Cargill. I mean, Cargill's a secret family. I mean, it's not like these aren't active characters. So how do you make that into an active voice as you write a chapter,
mm-hmm.
when I'm telling you this, all this like farm bill history? I mean, that just took a lot of workshopping. But then my editor, I mean, she's a professionally trained writer, and she would, I mean, it's one of those things where like she would cut sections that really keep me on track, where like, for example, I really got obsessed with California's water system. And so I had like 3,000 words just telling people the history of California's water system.
Mm.
But in the end of the day, strawberries are only grown on the coast of California. So like, that's not relative to the chapter. So she just cut it. But it took me about a week to admit she was right. But you know, I mean, that's what it takes.
Just have to tell people to watch Chinatown, I guess.
Oh my God. I am not even joking, Michael. I joked one night on vacation a few months ago to my husband that like there's totally an updated version of Chinatown in my Hog Baron chapter.
It could be. And so this is the thing, right? Like, and even in your Beef Baron one, like there is like there are films to be made of some of these stories.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest with you, that's my dream here is I just view this book as step one, is really distilling these ideas, putting these stories out there. But like I could never do it justice to put into words what it is to be inside one of these industrial animal facilities. You know, it's first of all, that's also why I'm a big believer. I love going to these things. To me, I just have to see it and be in these spaces to just really understand it and get my head around it.
You mentioned about, you know, owning the middle. I think it's in the conclusion that you talk about, you know, an article of yours was published in American Conservative, and that, you know, your argument for, you know, return to more locally oriented food system isn't necessarily like a leftist idea. It is a, you know, centrist idea, that it resonated with conservatives as much as it does with like small L liberals. Like, do you see, because admittedly, like as soon as people start talking about like environmental protections, for the most part, people assume that's a very leftist thing and a portion of the right's just going to dismiss it out of hand. But when it comes to, you know, the economic aspects of these things, it is a small C conservative notion at times. Do you think like that's why that makes this like a middle issue for you?
100%. I mean, that is, and part of it is you just got to workshop this language. I mean, I publish a lot, as you said, a lot in the American Conservative because I was testing rhetoric, testing ideas, and just kind of, you know, the feedback. I mean, I love it when people reach out. I love seeing how this stuff plays online. And then even like, you know, I've given a lot of speeches over the last few years, and, you know, you're just kind of seeing how different audiences take in things. And to me, it's all about having like a top line, you know, simple message. And then you kind of, you know, you frame it differently depending on the audience. Like, to me, the biggest thing we can do in American agriculture and the food system is put animals back in the land, you know, in this industrial animal, these animal facilities. And I mean, what a simple, it's such a pro-farmer message. It's good for the animal. It's good for the environment. It's a real revitalization thing. And so, but that is, you know, you kind of, that sub-message, you kind of tailor based on the audience, but you have this overarching top-line thesis.
You mentioned, you know, like chapters being a litmus test as to who, like who responds most to which ones. The book's been out for a little bit. What kind of, like, have there been surprises for you as to like which ones either resonate or anger people or fire people up?
Yeah. The one that doesn't hit the slaughtering burden one, I thought would hit with people more than it does, but I think everyone just kind of knows how broken the meat markets are. I think that's part of it. Driscoll's, people are just fascinated by it. And I think it's because there's such a disconnect between their public image in that chapter. And it's very rare in the produce section do you have a branded item. And right. They have a very bourgeois brand. And so I think that's why people are really fascinated about that undercurrent.
Speaking of brands, like some of these brands have like a budget version and like you're buying from the same company, even though you don't know you are.
Yeah, it's all about the illusion of choice. I mean, that to me reflects the inequality of this moment of the higher income consumer wants to think they're getting a different product than the lower income consumer, but it's really the same product wrapped up differently. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the story of my coffee baron. That's the story of JBS. I mean, a lot of these, I mean, it used to be back in the day, you had Standard Oil was just one thing. Now they realize, you know, have different brand points for different marketing messages, but also like you don't realize the power they have is because it's all these different, you don't realize these brands are really just one company.
Yeah. As for writing these, was there one that was harder than the others in terms of researching? So like, you know, obviously Cargill is kind of a faceless entity in some sense. Like, did that make it more difficult, or because they've written, you know, like family history and stuff, there's at least some information out there?
It was actually, I'm not kidding. The hardest chapter to write was the coffee chapter. And actually the one that's really popular with people. It's that one, because from like a narrative perspective, that's not a linear chapter. I'm literally bouncing around from Panera Bread to the Nazis, to Robert Bork, to Louis Brandeis, to my mom's coffee store. Like, that chapter is kind of, I mean, it took my editor, we almost, my publisher wanted to junk it at one point, and it just wasn't coming together. But I was so adamant. I'm not only telling the history of antitrust in America, but really making that point of, especially this moment, that monopolists finance fascist. And that's like the undercurrent of that chapter. It's just like, there's really an underappreciated relationship between those two. And so it was just, that one was 3 years of just thinking it was near death. You know, like, no, I need to bring it back to life, and like just playing with it, trying to get it to work.
So is it resorting the information in different kind of pathways, or like, what are you doing to like make sure that then becomes the chapter it becomes? Like, is it because you're bouncing around trying to thread the needle in some sense? Like, how do you kind of land on what you end up with and make sure that you get that chapter in?
That one was a lot of condensing more, and then really, so they're almost, I view them as sections, like, you know, there's those section breaks where really sanding them so that you understand the transition of why am I going from Panera to Hitler. Sorry, I'm using that ridiculous an example, but like really those few sentences around those transition points on each side of the transition, making sure the reader understands where, why are we now pivoting? And also, like, it took me a while just to really connect them all in my head of why am I telling you this history of Panera Bread, and then understanding this, letting the reader know I really, like, why this is really important that you understand, like, the value of my mom's coffee store.
So it's like, here, I've got a connection here. I'll show you how I make it. Trust me that I'll get there, kind of a thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And it's like, these ideas are like really, I'm trying to do it in an incredibly efficient way. I mean, it is, I think I didn't expect with this book is people, a lot of reviewers have noted, I have an insane amount of footnotes.
Mm-hmm.
I have like 50 pages of citation for an only 200 page book. And so like, this book is incredibly tight and edited. Is I just feel like with smartphones, we read differently. Like, I just wanted to keep moving. Some writers will say the same thing over and over in three paragraphs. I just said it once and moved on. And that just took me time to like really distill my thoughts, connecting all these different dots.
To write quickly took longer.
Yes. It's weird. Like, that is, but it's also a reflection of the concentration of the book industry. I mean, it is, most authors now, you have to put together your own tour. You have to do your own publicity. I was told by a lot of people in the industry, a book like this is not economically viable. And, you know, you just have to prove people wrong sometimes.
You mentioned that, you know, the book is kind of phase one. Like, are you working on something as a follow-up, or are you looking at, you know, making this into like a documentary television series or something? Like, what do you foresee for the future of this?
Oh man, Michael, you're hitting like everything. No, I mean, a docuseries would be my dream here.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be like, you know, the home run in the ballpark. I don't know. I'm very much of see what opportunities come your way. Maybe add a Baron or two in a paperback. Maybe do another book. I don't know. I'm very much a believer in, we live in such a volatile moment. You can't overthink things. You know, in the day, I really like doing this food system kind of work, and you just kind of take things as they come.
Well, if there's another book, I'd love to have you back on to talk about it, Austin. The book is Barons, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry, out through Island Press. Austin Frerich, thanks very much for joining me on the program and discussing the book, and congratulations on its release.
Thank you so much for having me on, Michael. Thanks again for those really good questions.